Court. My name is Erin Choi, and I am pro bono counsel for the petitioners in this asylum case, Gloria Marina Diaz-Rivas and her daughter, Liliana Sofia Gutierrez-Diaz. Your Honors, Ms. Diaz-Rivas and her daughter came to the U.S. in 2015 seeking asylum from El Salvador. There are a number of issues in this case, but for purposes of the limited time we have for argument, I will focus on just two today, unless Your Honors would like to discuss others. Namely, I will discuss the gang persecution claim and also the equal protection claim. So in this case, turning first to the gang persecution claim, this case must be reversed and remanded because the board's decision that there was not a sufficient nexus between the harm and the fears that Ms. Diaz-Rivas had and her membership in the Gutierrez Diaz family was not supported by substantial evidence, and a proper mixed motive analysis was not applied. Because the IJ and the board ignored uncontroverted evidence and failed to conduct this appropriate mixed motive analysis, this was reversible error. In particular, there's no dispute that a mixed motive analysis was not done by the IJ. The IJ performed a cursory nexus analysis and misapplied legal standards and failed to even address whether Ms. Diaz-Rivas' membership in the Gutierrez-Diaz family, which is the particular social group at issue, was or will be at least one central reason for persecution by the gangs. The IJ's
rationale, at least in part, was that this was sort of retaliation for complaints, and therefore it wasn't family-based, right?
That's correct,
in part.
In part, yes. And just with respect to that, though, it was erroneous for... it was inappropriate for them not to explicitly assess whether membership in the family, however, was at least one central reason for the persecution, irrespective of whether there may have been other unprotected grounds for which she was persecuted.
Wasn't there evidence in your client's favor that some of the conduct by MS-13 began before there were complaints or protests?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there's evidence in the record that from the government that, if you could actually, could you restate the question, if you don't mind?
No, it's a friendly question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There was at least some evidence before the IJ that some of the conduct that you claim was family-based took place before the grounds that the IJ asserted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which suggests, at least in one plausible view, that at least some of the conduct of MS-13 was based on family membership.
That's correct.
And not protest or denials by the family in terms of what the gang wanted to leave them alone.
Yes, Your Honor. And in addition, we would submit that it's not the reasons for targeting the gang are not the relevant issue here. The issue is that there is an animus against this family by the gang, and that the gang is targeting the family, and that she is being targeted as a member of that family that is targeted, is the central issue here, and that is an analysis that was not performed by the IJ or the board.
My point is that, and I don't know if I have it right or not, but my point is that the magistrate judge thought in part that the reason for the targeting was that Ms. Diaz-Rivas and family members went to the police, to the military, to the authorities.
Uh-huh.
But one critical fact that's undisputed before that is that Mr. Gutierrez disappeared.
Yes, Your Honor.
Probably because of something having to do with MS-13 before there were the complaints about his disappearance.
That's correct.
And so there's... it seems to me a decent basis for thinking that at least the initial targeting was family-based and maybe not necessarily just complaint-based.
Yes, Your Honor. And indeed, we have in this case uncontroverted corroborating evidence of it being she being targeted because of her membership in the family in the form of the police report from Sergeant Reyes, the El Salvador police, in the record at A124, which says that the gang has given the green light to kill the Gutierrez-Diaz family and no other reason, that they're targeted because if any of them appear at that area or the area where the gang conducts its activities, they would be killed and their bodies would disappear, as was the case with the brother who had disappeared.
And so, yes. I'm sorry if I missed this, but was that before or after the family reported the brother missing?
The police report is after the family reported her missing. However, in this case, it was because the analysis was not done as to whether she should have whether she was sought to be harmed, whether they sought to harm her because of her membership in the family. And so that was erroneous, and it was a reversible error when you don't conduct that explicit mixed motive analysis that's required. And so the focus on the gang's reason for targeting the family rather than her membership in the family itself was incorrect. And indeed, just to point out, the IJ in this case wholly failed to consider the police report in the context of the gang violence claim, and instead merely used the presence of a police report in the or the lack of a police report in the domestic violence claim against her in comparing as to they filed a police report with respect to this disappearance, but then didn't even acknowledge that the police had specifically said in this report that the green light license to kill was to the family itself and not for any other reason. And that they had received death threats and had the necessity to move abroad in that police report at A124. So it was critical evidence that was not considered at all by the IJ, and then the board did not look at that independently either. So for those reasons, the standard that was applied here was incorrect, and the evidence, substantial evidence in the record that wasn't considered compels a contrary finding. And so this case should be reversed and remanded on that reason to a different immigration court. As I will explain with respect to our equal protection issue, if I may switch gears to that. With respect to the equal protection issue, when you look at the mistakes that were made in this case on the analysis that was done with the mixed motive issue, as well as other mistakes in the IJ's decision, coupled with the Atlanta Immigration Court's shockingly low asylum grant rate of only 2%, compared to the average national grant rate of 46% in other immigration courts across the country during that same period, coupled with the evidence of this in this case of the IJ deciding this case on personal bias rather than the actual evidence,
that latter argument is based on some of the comments that the IJ made about at the beginning of the hearing about the type of claim that was being presented and how there were many of these.
Yes, Your Honor. He described it as this is another one of those cases, and that, in addition, just throughout, ignored evidence in the record inexplicably and used evidence when convenient for him to.
Well, but generally, that's the province of a fact finder. And a fact finder can decide to accept some evidence, reject some evidence, find some persuasive, find not persuasive. And again, generally speaking, only. Incorrect legal or factual rulings by a judge doesn't necessarily equate to bias or partiality.
That's correct, Your Honor. But when coupled with, we see an overwhelming denial of asylum applicants' applications in this court, and that coupled with the statements here throughout the record, more so than just saying that this is one of those cases, without even inexplicably just ignores the testimony of our expert witness based on his own personal view of the facts, which is not even in the record, and saying he ignores the evidence from the expert that because on the basis of he says that, excuse me, he says that the so okay, excuse me. There's just a number of examples that he says everyone is okay, the rest of her family is okay in El Salvador. But there's no evidence in the record of that, one way or the other. We don't know in the record if everyone's okay. And that for him to say that everyone is okay and that's why he won't consider the expert's testimony, it's not supported by the record. And in addition, he, like I said, used the police report when it's convenient on the rape claim and saying that she, you know, she showed that she was able to file a police report in one instance, so then why couldn't she have done it in the other instance, but then doesn't even consider the police report or mention it at all in the context of this, even though it's uncontroverted in the record. No, the credibility of that document has not at all been called into question, and it's just wholly ignored. So the fact of that, and then also the statements that the judge made about her not having a fear of future harm when there was no evidence that when she was had left her home to go to the other location in El Salvador for a couple of weeks while she tried to get a passport, there was evidence in the record that they received threatening phone calls saying that the gang knew where they were, and that the IJ didn't even acknowledge that at all. And so for those reasons, the record is riddled with evidence and examples of this type of predisposition, and the fact that the judge looked at this as he viewed it as a case where they're just fearing general gang violence, but that couldn't be further from the truth in this case, Your Honors. She feared very specific threats to her family, and the threats were on account of her membership in that family. So I see my time is up, and I will...
No, you've got a couple of more questions
okay.
for me. And I'll ask Ms. Lack the same question. It appears that neither one of you think that the acting attorney general's request for review of In Re LEA affects anything in this case, even though that BIA decision deals with membership in a social group like a family. You're confident that that doesn't affect anything and that we shouldn't wait to see what Department of Justice does with LEA, that we can just go forward?
Yes, Your Honor, we can go forward. In this case, in the case below, there was no, it was presumed to be a cognizable social group, so that's not an issue here. And the issue in LEA has not been decided, and we submit that it should not hold up the court's review of this matter.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Choi.
Thank you.
You've saved your time for rebuttal. Ms. Slack.
May it please the court, Michelle Slack on behalf of the United States Attorney General. Petitioner in her brief raises four issues.
Before you get to those, so I don't interrupt you.
Yes, Your Honor.
You also believe that the fact that the acting attorney general has requested review and briefing in LEA doesn't affect what we do here and we should go forward? That's what you said, and that's what Ms. Choi said in your 28J letters. I just want to make sure that both of you have that view.
Perhaps I should clarify, Your Honor. It is the government's position that based on this court's existing mode of analysis addressing what does it mean to be one central reason for the persecution that is being alleged, the court can move forward, because in this particular case, the board merely assumed that family could be a particular social group and didn't actually decide that issue. That would have to be decided if the court does not think that the mode of analysis was correctly done in this case. But I will
did you concede, not, I don't mean you personally, did the department concede before the IJ that family membership under the right circumstances was a cognizable social group for purposes of persecution?
Concede no, Your Honor.
What did the government tell the IJ on that point?
It's not addressed in front of the IJ.
What position did the government take in its written papers on that issue?
That actual issue was never addressed by the immigration judge or the Board of Immigration Appeals.
No, I'm talking about the government on the litigation side, not the IJ or the BIA. What, if anything, did the attorney for the government tell the IJ about that issue at the hearing? Did it did he or she take any position, make any mention, say anything about it, or just proceed as though the issue were non-existent or something else?
It took no position that I'm aware of during the hearing in front of the immigration judge about whether or not any of the purported social, particular social groups were cognizable.
Took no position at all, just told the IJ, go forward, we'll assume, you don't have to decide, they lose on other grounds. They didn't say any of that?
They lose on other grounds was the position taken, that was unnecessary in this particular case. And the board takes the same position, that it's going to assume, for purposes of argument in this case, that it is cognizable, but that they failed to demonstrate the motive, the on account of requirement.
Okay.
And I just want to say then, to clarify, the acting attorney general certification in LEA does suggest that we could see anything come out of the certification of LEA, including under what circumstances family might be a particular social group. So in that vein, I won't say that it has no bearing on this case, but because of this court's case law, granted mostly unpublished case law, conducting a similar mode of analysis, it doesn't seem like it's necessary to either stay this case or remand it in light of the certification.
Okay.
Of the four issues that are raised in the brief by petitioner, they fall into two categories. Two of the issues relate to fact-finding. Two of the issues relate to constitutional claims. I'm going to begin by addressing the fact-finding, and in particular, I'd like to address the fact-finding that was at issue during petitioner's opening argument, that having to do with the gang-related asylum claim. The Board of Immigration Appeals actually did conduct a mixed mode of analysis, but found that to whatever extent family relates to this case, it is merely tangential because there is no indication of an animus against the respondent and her family based on biological ties, historical status, and other unique features of the family unit. This is very similar mode of analysis that this court conducted in Medea Acosta very recently, in which the court held that there was no evidence of animus against the family independent of a land dispute and a feud over a nephew's death.
But animus comes from somewhere. Animus just doesn't drop out of the sky. It usually begins with something. And then it leads to targeted action, sometimes.
Sometimes.
It's not like if you're born and you say, I have a hatred for the Gutierrez family, and when I become of age, I'm going to exact vengeance on the Gutierrez family. I mean, animus comes from somewhere. There's a reason for it. And it's not inconceivable that something that might arise, that might begin with a payment of more extortion money, may then turn into a family matter and a family animus.
Yes, Your Honor.
Think of Romeo and Juliet. Over time, I know it's a fictional story, but over time, that animus became family-based. Whatever the initial reason for the slight might have been. You don't think that's a possibility?
Over time, Your Honor, it became just a family dispute, essentially a family feud. In fact, I've thought a lot about how the Capulets and the Montagues do present kind of a fictional setting in which family might possibly be. But again, as I'm reluctant to address too much when family might be a particular social group, given that's exactly what the acting attorney general said.
We're trading on that assumption, aren't we? And you've told us to go forward. If if you didn't challenge that below, and I'm not saying you waived anything, but if you didn't contest it below, and the IJ didn't address it and assumed it, and the BIA assumed it, we have to assume it here too, right? Because you're not asking us to hold that family membership can never be a protected social group, right?
No, Your Honor, it would have to be remanded if you found that.
And you're not asking for a remand.
Well, if the case cannot be sustained upon the reasons given by the agency, it would have to be remanded.
No, I know that, but you're not affirmatively asking for a remand.
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
You think a denial of the petition is in order.
Correct.
So if you're asking for that, and you haven't affirmatively asked in your brief for us to hold as a matter of law that membership in a family can be protected status, don't we have to proceed on the assumption that it can be if we go forward now despite LEA?
For purposes of addressing whether or not this particular case involves threatened persecution on account of.
Right. For yes. This case, we have to make that same assumption, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you're not asking us to hold to the contrary as a matter of law.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so that assumption then exist and we take it too, correct or not correct? For purposes of deciding this case, we assume at the very beginning that membership in a family is protected social status for asylum purposes. And then the question for us is whether or not the BIA erred in finding that whatever happened here was not an account of that family membership. Is that the way the analysis proceeds or no?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor, like a 12B6. You don't necessarily have to decide everything if there's some element of a cause of action that there isn't sufficient allegations. It's along those lines. We would, if family is a particular social group, then we would address the next component required element of an asylum claim being that it has to have a motive of the persecutor on account of that particular social group.
Now, Ms. Diaz-Rivas, this is a derivative petition, right?
Yes.
How do we address the daughter's claim if the daughter never complained to the authorities? How can you say that the daughter's claim was that any threats against the daughter, any persecution against the daughter were on account of the complaint to the authorities and not something else?
That the daughter's claim stands or falls as a derivative based on whether or not the mother's claim stands or falls.
You don't.
It's not making a separate claim. It's a derivative of the mother's claim.
But so you don't evaluate the daughter's circumstances separately?
Not in a derivative claim, Your Honor. But I would like to address the family context of it. According to the petitioner's testimony, the entire family was looking for Mr. Gutierrez. Fidel Gutierrez, the children, her sons, the brothers, the sisters, her, they were all engaging in the search, and they were all seen by gang members. There's no suggestion that there's any particular family member that wasn't somehow involved in reporting to the police and searching for
brother-in-law. Let's talk about practical reality on the ground.
Okay.
You think that if Ms. Diaz-Rivas and her family members had not gone to the authorities, that MS-13 would have just left them alone?
Well, they, like most people...
we took one of your family members, you're good.
Your Honor, it's hard to say what they would have done.
Yes, it is very hard to say what they would have done.
But
that the only reason that MS-13 poses a threat to Ms. Diaz-Rivas and her family members is because they complained to the authorities, it seems to me ignores the very crucial antecedent fact that they took Mr. Gutierrez before there were any complaints. It's not as if threats and problems began after the Gutierrez Diaz Rivas family complained to the authorities about the extortion demands, right? That would be a different scenario. So if Mr. Gutierrez or other family members went to the authorities and said, hey, they're asking for, I've been paying them this amount of money for a long time, but now they're asking for double or triple, I can't afford it, I need the military's help or the police's help, and then something happened, okay, I can see that there's maybe a causal break there. But here, before there were any complaints to the authorities, MS-13 had already taken action. They had already disappeared.
Yes, Your Honor, but the evidence suggests it wasn't because of family that Mr. Gutierrez was disappeared. It was because he stopped paying the extortion.
But the question is not Mr. Gutierrez. The question is the threats to the others. And once he's been taken, you think there's no on account of after he's been taken that now the family is seen as getting a free pass, that there's nothing else that is going to happen to the family because MS-13 has taken its pound of flesh?
But no, it would possibly be because no one is paying the extortion anymore in this case. There's evidence throughout the record,
Your Honor.
You
have such a very different view of the way that gang activity works in Latin America than I do.
But that gang activity is something that everyone in Central America is facing.
And they act, and MS-13 acts under a code of conduct that says, hey, you know, we killed one of yours, but if you pay, everything is going to be okay. We're not going to hold it personally against you, and we're not going to have any animus against your family members, despite what your patriarch may have done.
Do we know if MS-13 sought extortion payments from the remaining family members?
There's no evidence that they did, that they were threatening them because they wanted them to stop searching for Fidel Gutierrez. That's what the record reveals that the threats were based on.
And do we
know should stop searching for him.
Do we know anything about the original genesis of their extortion requirements from Mr. Gutierrez?
Just that he was a wealthy businessman and that they sought extortion money, women, clothing from him to protect the family, and that he could no longer keep up with their demands and stop paying it. And at that point, it appears that they sought revenge for the failure to pay the extortion. And then from there, it became about the reports to the police and the search for Fidel Gutierrez. It's throughout the record. It's in the petitioner's testimony. It's in the expert's testimony. It's even in the letter from Sergeant Reyes that was the reason for the threats against them. I see that my time is over. There are no further questions.
You're going to stay up a little longer.
Okay.
Because I've got a couple of more questions for you, if you don't mind. The BIA said, with regard to the equal protection claim, that it had no jurisdiction to assess the claim. But it cited only a BIA decision that said that the BIA has no legal authority to strike down a federal statute as unconstitutional. Isn't there a big difference between a denial of due process, let's say in a hypothetical case that an IJ prevents a petitioner in an asylum case from presenting any evidence whatsoever and says, I don't want to listen to your evidence, listens to the government's evidence, but not the petitioner, denies asylum relief, appeal to the BIA. The claim is denial of due process. I was denied a chance to present my side of the evidence. I had my witnesses there. I had done everything the judge had asked. I didn't get a chance to present any evidence whatsoever, and that's why I lost. My due process rights were violated. Please reverse and remand for an evidentiary for a hearing. Does the BIA have jurisdiction to address that claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though that's constitutional?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why not address the constitutional claim in this case then?
I believe because like legislation, it's something that cuts across. This equal protection challenge is a systemic challenge. It's essentially saying the entire court system has these differences in the way that statistically cases are being handled.
Where do you raise such a claim then in an original habeas petition under 2241 in a federal district court in Atlanta?
I'm not sure where it could be raised, Your Honor. In this particular... Let's
make the facts just a little bit worse for you in a hypothetical. And you tell me where this claim, and I'm not talking about the merits of the claim, I'm talking about the justiciability of the claim. Let's say that for a period of 5 years, the immigration court in a given city, whatever city we can think of, was denying asylum applications from wherever and by whomever at a 100% clip. Nobody was getting relief, 100% for 5 years. How would that claim get adjudicated?
Well, first of all, in the first instance, it would get adjudicated in the individual.
No, I'm talking about the systemic claim, that there is something seriously wrong with the immigration court in that jurisdiction because not a single person has gotten asylum in 5 years. And that can't possibly be correct, assuming the numbers are big enough to be able to have a statistical sampling. Where does that claim get adjudicated? I'm not talking about how the claim comes out. I just want to know where it gets litigated.
It would have to be someplace where you could build a record. I would say in it, possibly under 1331 in district court, raising an equal protection challenge. But in this particular case, this isn't an equal protection claim. An equal protection claim, generally speaking, comes when there's an expressed classification and differentiation between two groups of similarly situated people. In this case, there is no express differentiation in
the way that because they're all aliens.
No, it's...
Because they're all being treated the same. They're all being denied, and they're all aliens, so there's no equal protection claim.
There's nothing that says, Atlanta, you have a quota, you're only allowed to approve 2%.
No, you're right. You're right. But numbers don't always tell a story, and you've got Disraeli's very famous quip that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And so I'm aware of the fact that numbers don't always tell you a story and can often be misleading. But numbers can sometimes begin to tell a story. And the difference between the rate of asylum grants elsewhere in the country in Atlanta is pretty stark, do you think, or not?
But you also have all these different factors that may be in the mix.
Like?
You don't have similarly situated persons.
No. What are the other factors? Atlanta isn't taking asylum applications only from people from Jamaica or people from Great Britain. They're taking them from everywhere, like every other jurisdiction in the country.
So
how do you explain
different
that?
Countries, different kinds of asylum claims, substantially less claims get granted based on particular social group than they do on the ones that are actually specified in the statute. Whether or not there's credibility issues, whether or not there are issues with regard to the nexus requirement.
You're trying to bring it back to an individual analysis. And I'm suggesting to you that when the numbers may get big enough, the disparity may get big enough, maybe there's a reason to dig a little bit more and find out why. Maybe you're right. Maybe all of that disparity gets explained by individual circumstances, that many of the asylum applicants in Atlanta were from these countries where there generally isn't persecution, and the State Department reports generally say things are okay there. Maybe they're by people who had very weak claims of membership in a protected social group. Maybe all of those people were found not credible. But without all that information, these numbers create a very, very troubling image.
And it's just that, Your Honor, that we may need more. We don't have, on this record, we don't have an equal protection claim, Your Honor.
Be careful what you wish for, because if that case gets filed in a federal district court with federal question jurisdiction, maybe not as an equal protection claim, but as a due process claim, and discovery begins, whew.
And actually, Your Honor makes a good point. In the end, this really just sound like a repackaging of the petitioner's due process claim.
No, those are different claims. Because this claim, whether it has merit or not, whether it's justiciable or not, is a systemic claim. Her other due process claim is individual to her and what happened to her in her case. This one is there's something rotten in the immigration court in Atlanta because you can't explain those numbers.
It's a suggestion that all of the immigration judges in Atlanta are biased against asylum applications.
Or that they have an unwritten quota, right? Or that they've been given a certain message that numbers are not supposed to be above a certain number, and they're applying that message with a vengeance. There are a lot of possible good possibilities for that disparity, a lot of them innocent and a lot of them explainable. There are also a lot of really bad ones.
But it sounds a little bit like the Supreme Court's decision in Walmart versus Dukes, Your Honor. We're talking about individual discretionary decisions made in individual cases with individual facts, and asylum is very fact-based.
You're not as troubled by the disparity in numbers as I am, so we'll leave it at that. But thank you very much for your argument, Ms. Falk. We really appreciate it. Ms. Slack, I'm sorry. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Choi, you have 4 minutes for argument.
Thank you.
How do you win on that claim by just showing raw numbers, assuming the claim is even justiciable?
Your Honor, statistical evidence of a discriminatory impact is sufficient to show intent and unequal application of the law, and that.
But not always. It may be. Enough to get you over the prima facie case bar in some scenarios, but it doesn't always do that because disparities in numbers can sometimes be explained in a way that is appropriate and neutral.
Correct, Your Honor, but in this case, the disparity in numbers coupled with the evidence in our case of what has happened and the failure to consider the particularized circumstances of our client are indicative of this pervasive bias.
No, but now you're trying to link an individual claim with a systemic claim.
Yes.
And those two things don't marry very well, it seems to me.
Your Honor, regardless, at a minimum, we request a remand to a different immigration court for a consideration, at least in our client's case, on her particular issues in a different court. But
did you assert that claim, or you or Ms. Diaz-Rivas assert that claim before the IJ?
The Atlanta Immigration Court issue?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. We raised it in the Board of Immigration Appeals, I believe.
Okay. Why do you think the BIA has jurisdiction to address that claim?
The BIA has jurisdiction to address the equal protection claim.
Why do you think it does?
We think it does because the claim is relating to that court's unequal application of a law that is facially neutral but then is being applied in a way that is discriminatory and unequal, and that is within its province to do. They declined to do so, but that was not appropriate.
Would the BIA have remedial authority only as to your client, or are you suggesting that they would have a broader remedial authority on that claim?
Your Honor, I believe in this case we contend that it's related to our client's case in particular, and we do believe there is a systemic issue. But we've requested, in terms of the relief, remand and to a different court for our client because her equal protection rights have been violated. On the question of the systemic issue, would be happy to provide further briefing to the court on that if that would be helpful. But
well, Ms. Slack says in part that if what you're really seeking is systemic relief, then what you're looking at are class-based allegations to be able to get some sort of injunctive or remedial relief. And I think that's one of the things that Judge Grant was asking you about, whether the BIA has the authority to even provide that sort of relief, should it be inclined to grant you any.
Yes, Your Honor. I cannot answer definitively right now. I would, but would be happy to further look into that. It's my understanding. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. But at least as to our client, we believe that this is the proper approach and remedy in terms of addressing the overall statistics and the systemic problem. I'm not totally.
Well, the raw statistics that you're referring to, somewhere I read in all of this proceedings that, for example, in Buffalo, New York, they don't grant any. And in El Paso, Texas, which I'm a little familiar with, the same 2% that you're arguing is way insufficient. And I remember somewhere else in regards to this record. So statistically, that those figures don't seem to help you any, and it sure doesn't show any disparate treatment if you're going to say all of those courts are not treating people fairly. Those statistics help you?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we're not necessarily making statements about those other courts and the statistics. Atlanta is the third highest.
I understand that, counsel, but you're quoting statistics saying that 2% is evidence of the fact of the disparate treatment of that court. But I'm saying that other courts don't have any better percentages than that either.
Your Honor, those other courts that you're talking about, and I don't have it in front of me right now, but I believe, like for the Buffalo example, there was a 0% grant rate because there were zero applications that year. So
that's the statistics of it, though.
That's correct. But, you know, looking at those numbers are on the document that we provided and the statistics that are available. And so you can see the number.
Well, how about El Paso, which I'm a little familiar with in regards to the number there? I think it showed that it was only a 2% grant. Isn't that correct, your chart?
Let's see, Your Honor. El Paso is 2%, but again, the numbers are significantly lower than in this court or in the Atlanta Immigration Court. So it's still, the numbers are not, comparing the percentages, I see
the
point
is that there are numbers and there are statistics, and I think
the
judge addressed that what statistics sometimes show you.
Well, if we're just talking about the numbers, though, we have in the Atlanta Immigration Court in 2016, only 14 applications for asylum were granted as compared to 590 that were denied. So essentially, the clear majority of people applying for asylum in that court are being denied. And
justly or unjustly, is that your position?
Well,
that statistic shows that all those other people were unjustly denied.
Your Honor, we know at least in our case, we believe to have been unjustly denied, so that's our position on that. And just to mention, the government hasn't disputed the statistics and doesn't take issue with the grant rate being abysmally low in Atlanta. And so just wanted to point that out. And also, unless I guess I've run over on my time, are there any further questions before
You can wrap up.
Okay. I was just going to say, Judge Jordan, to your point, you're absolutely right that animus does not just drop from the sky. And in this case, the record supports absolutely that before there were these complaints to the police, there was absolutely evidence of the extortion of Fidel, and that turned into a family target. And so that's supported by our client's testimony in the record and the police report as well. And just for those reasons, we just ask that the court please reverse and remand this case for further proceedings.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Choi. Thank you very much for your pro bono service on behalf of Ms. Diaz-Rivas. And Ms. Lack, thank you very much for your argument as well. We're in recess until tomorrow morning.